This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. We're on remote. We are with John Doe, an American singer, songwriter, actor, guitarist, and bass player, founder of the LA punk band X. But today, he's our poet. John, welcome from Austin, Texas.
Hi, Grace.
Hi, John.
Good to see you.
When you heard that music, what did you think of it? Do you remember writing that?
Oh, vividly, yeah. It's a tribute to my friend who passed away a few years ago. Oh, God, I don't know, many years ago. I guess 5 years ago now. Michael Blake, who's also a writer, best known for writing Dances with Wolves. He wrote the book. He wrote the book and the screenplay. Mm-hmm. And it was a dear friend of mine. And he got dementia and spent many years doing a bunch of dumb stuff, saying a bunch of things that made us laugh. And he had a good sense of humor about it. But when he passed away, I just I found myself writing a bunch of songs that were sort of related to him, and ended up doing a record, a full LP, for my solo music.
What was that titled?
It was called The Westerner.
Yes. Well, you know, there must have been some things to overcome in writing that then. Did the lyrics and the music go together easily? Was there something to overcome?
Yeah, it was one of those fortunate pieces of writing that just came out, there was some work editing, you know, to make it fit the music. And usually for me, the words and music are separate. They kind of come at different times, and one might be inspired by the other or vice versa. With that one, I think it was the words that inspired the music. And Michael introduced me to riding horses, which I still do. And it's one of the, you know, loves of my life, is being connected to those big magical beasts and and all the goofy stuff that they do. And
such sensitive beings.
Oh, they're all intuition. They're all right side of the brain. It's all right now, right now, right now, right now, right now. It's all in the moment. And so you have to, they require you and ask you. First they ask you, and then they require you to be in the moment with them, because they can get scared or not.
Well, going back to our opening, Rising Sun, I want to tell you that what I hear is the truth. That what I hear in your music and your words is the truth with no artifice. And I believe it. So that's the highest praise I can give any artist when I say, I believe you.
Wow.
It's a beautiful title. It is a gorgeous piece of music. The guitar that you're playing is really, it makes my heart beat fast. So we'll be hearing more of your music now, and we're going to switch gears and go back to the start. Well, almost the start. Many years ago, I was teaching at Antioch College, and you were a young poet, a group of magnificent young poets, each of whom has gone out to contribute so much to the world and to art. It's so interesting that pod of people came together. What were you trying to find at Antioch?
I guess I was trying to find a way to express myself better. You know, I started writing like a lot of people, just to try to understand what I was going through, what I was feeling, you know, what things meant. And I figured, and I don't know, I was writing songs, but then I just started writing, period, you know, just writing words, whatever they became.
Do you want to know what I remember?
Yeah, I would love to.
I remember you as very serious about language and very amazed and very quiet and shy. Do you see yourself as that way? I knew you were cool. I knew you were a wild child and you're cool. But you, when you were in the moment with language, you really were, you were disciplined to language. And I saw you start to gather images. And so it is such fun to be able to see the poetry which will be coming out of you now at the other side of the cycle.
Yeah.
So tell us what happened after Antioch. Where did you go?
Well, actually, I want to stay at Antioch for a moment because all the tutorials that we had taught me so much, not just about writing, but about how to teach people. And I've used your methods of encouraging someone, telling them when they're being themselves, telling them when they're telling the truth, when they're doing something that's unique to them. And really underlining that first and making them feel like they're worth something, making them feel like they're doing something.
So do you mentor others, John?
I've done some poetry workshops and but just in like some younger musicians or I have done like some poetry in the schools. I did in LA when that program was happening. I did another couple things at private high school up in the mountains in California. But just to say that to let someone believe in themselves first, and then where the parts when they're kind of bullshitting themselves or they're pretending to be something that they're not, or they're doing something that's like less original or totally unoriginal, then just say, and maybe this part is not as good.
That sounds good.
And you also gave me some very serious gave me a sense of self and like what kind of writing I was good at, because I remember you saying very clearly, like, this is very cinematic. I feel like I'm watching a movie when I would do something.
You are cinematic. You still are cinematic. Yeah.
Well, I've leaned into that.
John Doe, you were at Antioch and your name was not John Doe then. So when you left Antioch, you continued workshops in poetry in Venice, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So you went to LA in 1980 and you started this fabulous.
No, it was actually right after I graduated.
Oh, right from Antioch, you went to L.A.?
Yeah, I spent another, like, 8 months or so. I went to L.A. Halloween of 76.
And you graduated in 75.
Yeah.
Where did you get the courage to pick up and go across country? What were you thinking?
I was thinking I wanted to get the hell out of Baltimore. No offense. But I felt a lot of negativity in the East Coast in general. I had been to New York. I'd seen the Talking Heads. I'd seen the scene in downtown New York City. I'd been to Max's Kansas City and saw the Heartbreakers and some other bands like that. But it was still this kind of like dark and rainy and cold, and I had just had it. I grew up in Baltimore. I'd lived there since I was in like second grade. So
yes,
and a lot, there's a lot of you can't do that. I remember I knew somebody that tried to do that and you couldn't do that, and so why even try? And it's like, I didn't want to have any part of that. And I was like, I wanted to
A spiritual journey from the beginning. And when you went to LA, you changed the whole scene, and you really made LA, they say, equal to New York and London for punk rock. And Jeff Himes, whom I consider the greatest music critic writing in America, who happened to be your classmate, has said that you did something no one else did musically. Do you remember what was said about that? He talked about the vocals, how they weren't in sync, but how you had one transgress the other and it made a new sound. Does that strike a bell with you, what he said?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was nothing intentional, it was nothing premeditated. It just, that's what we ended up with. And it's unfair to say that I changed everything or even anything because I was just I was one part of a much bigger whole, which was, you know, the whole punk rock scene and all the people that were playing that kind of music, all the misfits and people that didn't fit into any other sort of musical genre that found themselves in L.A. in, you know, 75 to 1980. You know,
your sound was different. Your sound was different.
It was, but everyone's was different.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the thing is that, in the early days of punk rock, there was a very wide net. You know, that's why someone like Elvis Costello or Nick Lowe or Chrissy Hynde or the Talking Heads or Blondie or the Ramones or, you know, any of these bands, they all fell into the same thing because they were part of then instead of part of the past.
Oh, wow. That's a good way to put it. That's a very good way. And at the same time, you were still continuing working on your poetry.
Yeah. I mean, as a Xene, my partner in crime in the band X, is without a doubt one of the most intuitive and greatest writers I know. She absolutely, I think she far outshines most other renown, and she writes all the time. She didn't have any like formal training or teaching, and she didn't read a whole lot of poetry at the time. I think she's caught up maybe some, but she just hears it. She just hears the words. She hears the music. She writes every day, all the time. She's a terrific writer. So I learned a lot from her as well, as far as playing with words and letting, you know, one word lead to another or play on another. And so I had a lot of help.
Yep. But beyond that, what interests me the most about you is how, at what point you learned to trust that language led to the heart. That is a secret that most writers, without that, they are not great writers. Mm. You found that, like, music did one thing, but words, actually, you could trust them to lead you to the heart. And that's what I hear in your music so much. But let's hear a poem.
Okay.
Which, and let me tell them again who you are.
So which, I don't have an order of which poems go where.
Well, let's see. Let's start with Promised Land.
Okay.
This is John Doe. His musical performances and compositions span rock, punk, country and folk music genres. He was an actor too and has dozens of TV appearances, several movies, including the role of Jeff Parker in the television series Roswell. But today he is our poet. Let's hear a poem.
Promised Land. My words are fire, my fist is raised. I got a question you can't answer. You hurt my sister with a doctor's hand. With poison water and blowing sand, let me go free. Don't tell me I can't. Let me go free to a promised land. Trees are singing, rocks are sighing. You hurt my sister. She didn't do nothing. Still you hate her and push her down again and again. She bites your hand as you cover her mouth. The wind is fire. The church is burning. The priest is dying. Children laughing with sweet revenge. Bullets flying. Windows crashing, it's all so quiet at the end.
That's very strong. You can't turn away from the first line, I'll tell you that. My words are fire. I mean, that is, we're in with the first line. My words are fire. So talk about that poem just a moment.
This song was inspired when someone I don't respect was appointed to a high office in the government, and it seemed to threaten women's rights. Some people will know who I'm talking about, other people will not, and I don't care.
It could it would fit a lot of people, John.
So yes, that's true. Anyway, it was not an election, it was an appointment. Anyway, so I have three daughters. I have some of the, you know, I'm blessed to be part of their life. My most serious creative partner, Xene, has been part of my life for over 40 years. It's important for people to be able to decide what they want to do with their bodies, what they want to do with their lives, and you know, the fact that we're still in the Stone Age regarding that, and it's infuriating. So this is written from the perspective of someone who was constantly wronged, someone who constantly has to fight for their voice to be heard, just to stand up and not have, you know, not to say something and then have some other white guy say it louder and then everybody go, oh yeah, that's the good idea, let's do what that guy said, you know. I've experienced that you know, through my association with people. So it was you know, this is kind of reworked, but the original was a lot messier, and I'm a big fan of editing in an intuitive way, not trying to let my logic get in the way too much. But it also became a song.
Oh,
which is on the last X record that we did just recently. So.
Was that the Best of John Doe?
No, this is called Alphabet Land. It's okay. It's a new record by X, which was released during the pandemic. We had recorded it just before, and you know, planned to wait until whenever to release it. And then the record company, who it's called Fat Possum, they're a good record company down in Mississippi, in Oxford, Mississippi, and they're very literary. They're super cool indie record company, and they said, let's just put it out. So we put it out in April of 2020.
Well, that answers my question. I was going to say, how can a poem ever be used for lyrics? And so I guess it can.
Yes.
And just to be teacherly for a moment,
sure.
Sometimes the poet doesn't always know what they're doing, but I just want to tell you something interesting. I want to tell you that the second stanza, I just think your S's are awesome. Trees, singing, rocks, sighing, sister, she, still, push, she. That is amazing. And I know you can't plan it ahead of time.
No.
It comes out of the blood. So just read that one stanza for us, please, the second stanza.
Okay. Trees are singing, rocks are sighing. You hurt my sister, she didn't do nothing. Still you hate her and push her down again and again. She bites your hand as you cover her mouth.
That's John Doe. Now let us have another poem. Okay. I'm looking at the Horseman.
Horseman. And this is for Michael Blake, who we just mentioned. Horseman. We used to be horsemen, riding wide endless grasses. We saw changes in the leaves and fur and clouds and stars. But all the horses have passed away. Their bridles in memoriam hang on roughly painted walls, and we don't call ourselves horsemen anymore. The hard-boiled eggs all rolled to one side of the pan. I used to make egg salad for the kids. And though I'm still chopping onions, they don't make me cry. It doesn't taste the same, since we don't call ourselves horsemen anymore.
Wow, that is an elegy, which is quite an original approach about time passing. Once again, as the reader, I have to say you did something interesting, which I'm going to call a volta, the second stanza, where you shift and turn a corner and go from this umbrella-like experience to hard-boiled eggs. It's really where we get our energy, right? That shift. Such a difference in tone, such a difference in subject. So, whatever made you do that?
I wish I knew.
Yeah.
It just maybe...
You trust yourself, that's what.
Well, yeah, I think that when I was experiencing the first stanza, when Michael and I would go horseback riding and you know, sense all these changes, it was also a point at which I was a young father. So I was kind of experiencing these two very, you know, deep in your psyche, and in my psyche, experiencing them simultaneously on, you know, one is outside and very broad, and one is inside and pretty small or contained. So maybe it was because I was experiencing them at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
what I like is the colloquial words. I just like your taking a big subject like loss and making it so everyday. So, I mean, who has not boiled eggs? You know, the reader, you got the reader at the eggs.
Yeah.
So what do you want the reader to feel when you write?
Oh, just feel, just pretty much any, you know, I mean, some, there are some moments of humor, but mostly it's reflective, internal and internally, you know, reflecting on things and just to come along on the journey, you know. Just experience the ride.
At what point, I don't know how to teach trust, but when you went from the horseman to boiled eggs, you took a risk and you trusted yourself. And that only comes from a lot of writing. But I do want to shift to your band for a minute and to your music.
But don't you think that you have to... I've always, you know, in music or in any kind of art, poetry especially, you have to believe that your audience or whoever's going to read it is kind of on your side and willing to take that leap of faith and is willing to kind of go with you as long as you're, I mean, there are some writers that just frankly make me mad because they make me feel stupid because they're doing, you know, they're so good and they're, you know, just hopping from one place to another and they're amazing. And I have a lot of respect for them, but I'm also kind of angry at times because they're just, I'm getting off topic, but I think it's like you're saying to jump from one thing to another is you have to expect your audience to kind of come along with you and to try to find that bridge that you're going to jump across a river or a stream and you want them to come with you. And yeah,
you hit a very good point, and that is the hardest thing, and that's called intuition. So that you have to know, like you say, there's an invisible bridge, but you have to make it get to the other side, to the reader.
Right.
But you, not everybody knows how to do this, and that's what I'm trying to say to you, that intuition is like knowing how much to say and to trust that your audience knows as much as you do.
Right.
But you're not this thing off of a great big Mount Olympus. You believe, what I think when I read your stuff, is that you believe that the reader knows everything you do, has felt everything you do, so you're safe. That's what I think. Just back to your music, though, did you study guitar formally?
Oh, no. Uh-uh. I just, like most musicians, self-taught, listened to records and, you know, picked up the needle and put it back and then put it back and then tried to mimic it. And,
The chords are just unbelievable. Did you write the lion's share of the music, the words and music for X?
I wrote the sort of the chord changes for a lot of the songs, but the way that the band interpreted them and Billy Zoom, the guitar player, and DJ Bonebreak, the drummer, the way that they interpreted them made the X sound.
Well, so, did you arrange it for them? I'm a novice.
We all did, you know. I mean, that sounds good, let's do it again. Or that sounds too long, let's cut it down. Or, you know, just, trusting each other you know, we didn't, like I say, there was nothing premeditated. There was nothing, it's just what we came up with and, you know.
Was it fun? Is it fun?
Oh, God, yes. Oh, God, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, like I was saying earlier, is I can't take credit for our effect on music because there was such a scene. Once you're part of a scene, whatever that is, it's much bigger than you are, whether, you know, whatever poetry scene that's happened or art scene that happens, you're just part of the thing. And it's kind of in the water. It's just all around.
Oh, that's interesting. Like a big consciousness that you're in. Yeah. Well, let us hear another song. What is the title?
A Little Help.
A Little Help. What album was this from?
This is also on the Westerner.
Okay, so we're going to hear that now.
I'm digging this ditch in the green, green grass. You're talking to the sun in the sky. Water's coming down the mountain behind where we sleep in this town. Trying to make a pond or maybe a lake where the water is fresh and clean. The sun says, okay. Walk home, your job is done for today. Help me, help me. Everybody needs a little help. Help me, won't you help?
Are your techniques different for each song you write? Are for each song you compose, do you have the same impulse but different techniques? Or is it like you have a skill set and you just draw from that, draw from different parts of that?
Oh, I guess I think a lot of it depends on, just recently I heard somebody say, if you're having trouble with your output, examine your input.
I love that.
And I thought, what? Why didn't I know this before? But it's a great thing. So I think each record or each, you know, book that people are part of, it's like it's a record of what has influenced you leading up to that.
I love that output and input because. Yeah. I always say you can't have more going out than is coming in, and that's why I make everyone read a new poem every day.
Right.
You just have to have that. Oh, that's a terrific saying.
So anyway, I would say that song was unintentionally influenced by listening to a lot of Cat Power, who I think is one of the great singer-songwriters. And she does this. She does something that's sort of it's smooth. it's beautiful, but it's not lazy, and it's not mellow. There's some, you know, edge to it, even if it's very listenable, you know. So I don't know. I mean, I had just gotten a piano for the first time in many years, and so I composed that song on piano. So it's the same skill set, but you don't want to. It gets a little harder as time goes on because you don't want to repeat yourself. You don't want to use the same chord changes. You don't want to use the same exact same rhythm. So you know it's a little, but you just keep digging into the intuitive, you know, what feels good, what sounds good, and then if you keep after it, then you'll find something.
It's just in collaboration with the divine, as far as I'm concerned. It certainly can't start up there with all that white spaghetti in your brain.
Right.
Where do those ideas come from? But you have written two books. What are the titles?
One is called Under the Big Black Sun, and the second one is called More Fun in the New World, which are both titles for X Records. Under the Big Black Sun was our third record, and More Fun in the New World was our fourth record. But just one last thing about the A Little Help is that the lyrics of that came from driving down Highway 5, which is right through the salad bowl of California, Interstate 5. And so you constantly see migrant workers picking fruit and picking vegetables. And they're, so that's where the I'm digging a ditch in the green grass comes from. And it's also I keep thinking about, there's two different ways of getting things done. One seems a little more male, which is to, you know, pound or wrench things into place and to make things happen. And another one seems a little more feminine, which is to just believe that things will happen and, you know, sort of manifest them and just sort of let them happen, you know. And so that's where the man in this song is digging a ditch and the woman is just talking to the sun. And the sun says, okay. And so she can walk home and then, you know, her work's done. But the little help part just comes from, everybody does need some help.
It's not a bad metaphor. A little digging a ditch is not a bad metaphor. All of it has more than one veil. All of your lyrics, they appear to be quite accessible and quite literal, but they really have a lot of wealth behind them. Well, your first book, what did you want the reader to know when you wrote it?
I wanted the reader to know that the LA punk rock scene was just as vital and creative as any of the other punk rock scenes, because since it came along like maybe a year or two afterward, the media had already covered the London and New York punk rock scene, and so the LA punk rock scene was like, oh yeah, didn't we already cover that, so whatever. And you know, there are great photographers in all three or four, how many ever scenes you want to, you know, consider. But they had already, you know, so LA always was sort of like the, you know, the also ran, the you know.
So. Not when you left it. No. Well, at the end of the 80s, it was not.
No, and it's influenced a lot of people, and I'm proud of that. But I wanted to give the reader a chance to experience it and to actually be there.
You know? Oh, I see. And your second book?
Basically the same thing. The first one was from 77 to 82, and the second one was 82 to 87.
Were they hard to write? What was your process?
Well, you know, my sweetheart and the guy that I wrote them with, Tom DeSavia, they kept telling me that I should write a book. I should write a book about LA punk rock. And it sounded like way too much work and too much discipline. And I was completely uninterested because I'm not really a like raconteur. You know, I don't hold forth. I'll tell a story now and then. But they kept saying, oh my God, you should write a book. And I was like, oh God, no, thanks. Why don't you write a book and I'll just, you know. And I also didn't want to be like the authority in quotes on this scene. So the best idea that I had about this whole process for both books was I'll get other people to write chapters. I'll ask Henry Rollins from Black Flag, and I'll ask Jane Wiedlin from the Go-Go's, and because as much as I supported women's roles in punk rock, I couldn't write from their perspective.
Good
and
point.
As much as, and as much as I've supported the Latino community coming into punk rock early on in L.A., I couldn't write from that perspective. So, you know.
You acknowledge other people, which is really a very high principle. But also, your modesty has remained with you throughout your entire life. Let us hear a poem. How about this gorgeous thing called She Came to Town?
Okay. Melting snow. Right. Here we go. Melting snow. She came to town with a cold and left when it snowed. Eight tiny bits of silver chipped from the mine. Houses cracked with ice. The plumbing leaked stories from old timers, but everyone knew they were untrue. She will not abide liars, cannot listen to blowhards crow and crow like a wren on a weather vane. A hunting bird tied to her right hand, and a cat walks at her feet. She sang a melody with the hawk and kept time with the tomcat. She stood on a hill where all the buildings would be built, looked to the sea, and called to the sailing ships.
That third stanza with your surreality just makes the poem. Read the third stanza again.
A hunting bird tied to her right hand, and a cat walks at her feet. She sang a melody with the hawk and kept time with the tomcat.
That is terrific. Now let's hear another poem. We can do Summer Came Early. It might be called Wide, Wide World. I'm not sure.
It's called Wide, Wide World, exactly. Wide, Wide World. Summer came early, with darkness and thousands of lights burning all night in office buildings, while a weak little breeze comes in the window. Orange blossoms make me queasy with their sweet, sweet smell. Where are you in this wide, wide world? Millions and millions lead outlandish lives. You are small. I am even smaller. Why do we sit on a sack of potatoes in the same damn field we picked last year? We pick the same scab that will never be a scar. That shitty little coffee table and my shitty little drink wait patiently for me to make up my mind. Where am I in this wide, wide world?
You know, authenticity is what I said. And I looked at each of your poems for a reason. And in this one, I came to the conclusion that it was so successful because you have a stanza and then you insert another stanza and then you fan out again on the third stanza. So it's sort of like a bow. Mm-hmm. You have a big idea, then you have an insertion like a knot, then you fan out again. Now, this is nothing you can do ahead of time. I don't think the poet can say this ahead of time, but I can see it. So I call this a successful poem, and we will hear a closing poem from you at the end. But until then, I just want to know one thing. What was it like being an actor?
Well, I still do it on occasion, and it's really good pay, Grace. That's what it's like being an actor.
Not more than poetry.
Just a little bit.
Aww. And you were Jeff Parker on the television series Roswell. Did that become part of your persona, or is it something you could take off like your clothes?
It was just being a clueless dad. So it was just easy as pie. You know, I'd say the most rewarding element to that and what it taught me was how to be quieter, how to do more with less, how to be more internal, and still have this, have a kind of a big impact. To you don't have to be loud to have impact.
Well, you knew that before.
No, not really. I mean, not in performance. I mean, maybe in some writing, but when you're recording, you can be very internal. Whereas when you're on stage, you have to be pretty broad. And like I say, the pay was great. I mean, there was some totally absurd situations that you get yourself into, and the people are crazy. And I got to work with some really fun people like Christopher Walken and Patrick Swayze.
But all of those things that have gone through you but are not of you have all been a platform for what you are every day. Everything you did is still what you makes you more what you are. So I think it's so interesting to watch you from a distance. And we would like to say that we're going to go out with a final poem from you and a beautiful song. We're going to hear more of The Rising Sun. So may we have John Doe, a final poem.
Yes, indeed. This is called Hotel on a Hill. The tips of your fingers brush mine as you lace our hands together. No one has taken and held my hand in so long. A tiny animal slips up my spine, settling warm at the nape of my neck. All turns white in my eyes. This hotel hallway smells of money, oriental patterns and gilded frames. Like a landscaped garden, the floral brocade wallpaper makes your face flash by that much faster. You're still holding my hand. Tender good night. The next morning, your lips brush mine in a kiss goodbye. They are smooth and dry, soft as driftwood. Now I walk to a dirty hotel as your car melts into Mission Street traffic.
Broken, warm-blooded horse, red-haired kid. He trusted her. His dad never did. Like summer fog, his mom checked out. His Uncle Bill was always hanging around. Sun. All he ever wanted was a little patch of sunlight.
Characters, situation, plot, the voice of John Doe. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. Program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan family and the Sinipet Fund, with support from Diane Wilbon Parks. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.
In an LA barroom.